One of the first questions that I'm asked when I say I'm speaking about China is, when were you in China? Well, my answer is very easy. I've never been in China. But neither has very many other Americans. Until a few years ago, until our president went there, China was actually closed to everybody. And for 25 or 30 years, hardly any Americans were in China at all. I don't know if there's any subject on which the American people is more, I shouldn't say ignorant, but certainly less knowledgeable than on China. One of the easy things about speaking of China is that you can take for granted that nobody else knows much about it either. So you don't have to know much more to know more than others. And yet it's one of the most fascinating subjects, I think, today. A couple of years ago, I got interested in it, long before President Nixon went to China. And the more I read, the more fascinating the subject became. It may have been due partly to the fact that 50 years ago, I was asked by the Board of Foreign Missions to go to China as a missionary. Well, I didn't go, but I've never lost my interest in China. So many things have happened in our own lifetime that no one really is able to describe the changes. About the China that used to be, people don't know a great deal about it. I find this reaction among American people, and I wouldn't be surprised if there are some of you here that react the same way. I don't want to know any more about China. When you say China, communist China, all the people see is a great red blob. It's a red country, and keep away from red communism. I don't find much Christian attitude in that kind of a response. I would like to believe that the command to love your neighbor as yourself would include the Chinese too, so that even on a very low level, we ought to be interested in China as other people of whom we are only a part of the world's population. But it isn't only, I suppose, because China's communist and China's red, but because it's so far away and it's so different. Even take a look at the Chinese vocabulary, Chinese writing is a mystery. We can't read it, we can't pronounce it. Even the names that we read in the newspapers seem to us to be rather difficult. So the whole thing is a haze or a maze, and we know very little about it. And yet, do you realize that we're talking about 1/4 of the world's population? China is larger than the United States by several tens of thousands of square miles. So here is a country that is as large as most of North America. And yet, in that one country, and in a very small part of that country, one out of every four human beings lives. To shut your eyes to 1/4 of the world's population and to say, I'm not interested in China, I don't want to know anything more about it, is simply to close your mind to a very large part of the humanity. China, even on the map, looks forbidding. It looks larger than in some senses it is, because the people of China do not live as the people of the United States. You might superimpose the map of the United States on that of China, and Peking would be in line with about Washington. And the northern part with Boston, and the southern part with about Georgia, though a very large part of southern China is south of a line that goes through Florida. So it's a little further south than the United States. But though it looks like a great mass of land, actually much of it is desert. And a great deal of it is mountain, so that 95% of the population of China lives along the eastern border, along the seacoast, down toward the south. So that when you think of the population of China, you don't think of all of this mass of land, but rather you think of a rather compact population skirting along the East China Sea and down to the South China Sea. What makes it more important to us today is that our own foreign policy is involved with China. You may say you don't care to know more about China, but after all, the destiny of the United States is very closely interwoven with China. That has been brought back to our consciousness by the events of recent years. But take a look at China and her neighbors, and you see how we cannot escape somehow being related to it. All along the northern border of China is Russia, a country that we think of more largely as part of Europe, and we are much concerned with our relations with Leningrad, Moscow, and the western part of Russia. But here you have a vast part of Russia that extends way over to the Pacific Ocean. And the dealings of Russia with China is one of the parts of the policy that we are trying to involve ourselves in. How do we act towards Russia? How do we act towards China? How does China act towards Russia? How does Russia act towards China? It's all one great problem. And what happens here, in a sense, happens also to America. There are those who think that the foreign policy of the United States is to play off the one against the other. If you can get Russia fighting China, or China fighting Russia, then the United States can stand on the sidelines and not be much concerned. And that is the interpretation, I think, that a good part of the world is paying towards Kissinger and Nixon's policy today. Nixon goes to Peking, but no sooner is he gone there than he has to go to Moscow and try to balance your relationships with one or the other. Well, we'll have a good deal more to say through the week as to what the relations of China and Russia are along this northern border, particularly up here in the northeast, where there has been the constant conflict between Russia and China. Then off here, beyond the map, is another of the great powers of the world, namely Japan. And what is the relationship of Japan to China, or to Russia, or to the United States? Just a week or two ago, the Prime Minister of Japan was in Washington. We're trying to improve our relations with Japan, which got the notion we were more interested in China than in Japan. But actually, one of the great question marks of China's future lies here in Japan. And we'll have occasion during the week to speak about how China and Japan have been fighting each other through history, and in more recent times on this Korean Peninsula. Some of us remember the Korean War. Well, this is the place where Japan, after the war, was involved with the North Koreans. And you have a division of North and South Korea, North Korea going to the communists, and we are supporting South Korea. But even more important than the North and the East, as far as the United States is concerned, is down here on the South. For as you come along the East China Sea, and past Formosa or Taiwan, and down to the South China Sea, here's North Vietnam. Vietnam runs this side of the map. You can't see it here, North and South Vietnam, and Thailand, Cambodia, Laos, Burma. They're all along the bottom of the map here. And you ask yourself, what are we doing way off there in Vietnam? And one of the things that we do not understand, I think, as fully as we ought, is that China has been concerned about what happens in Vietnam. We've never dared cross the line into China. As soon as the American bombers got across the line and got into trouble, and China has been watching us in Vietnam all of the time, because throughout history, Vietnam has been under the influence of China. China, in a sense, has claimed suzerainty over Vietnam. We've not only been at war with Vietnam, but in a sense, we've been struggling against what we're afraid of is Chinese domination of the South. There are those who think that what American policy has really been aimed at is to establish some kind of point down here in Cambodia or Thailand where we can sort of hold ourselves against this mighty empire of China. Over here is India, Pakistan, which have been in the news lately. So no matter where you look, around the periphery of China, you're involved in world politics. And for an American to say, I don't care about China, it's red, it's communist, don't tell me anything more about it, is simply to blind ourselves to the great fact of history. I would say that the emergence of China within the last 30, 40 years as a world power is more important than anything that has happened in Europe or Africa. Not only is it a country of vast population, but it's a country of a history of over 2,500 years. We Americans fall quite easily into the habit of thinking of ourselves as the most civilized of all peoples. Before Columbus ever came to America, there had been over 1,000 years of civilized history in China. The Chinese call themselves the Middle Kingdom. Middle of what? Well, to the Chinese, they're the middle of the world. To them, the rest of the world is barbarian. And the old Greeks used to divide the world into Greeks and barbarians. In the New Testament, you have Jews and Greeks and barbarians. Well, to the Chinese, China was the Middle Kingdom, and all the other countries of the world were barbarians. And there is a feeling still in the minds of China today that they are a people that is more civilized than other people. They can tell you that when they were building the cathedrals of Europe or building up the civilization of the Mediterranean, you had an old history that goes back 1,000 years before Christ here. We pride ourselves on some of our inventions. Printing, for instance. The Chinese were printing from blocks long before Gutenberg printed. Gutenberg didn't invent printing, the Chinese did. The Chinese invented gunpowder. Still a little bit of it from the Chinese crackers that you had, firecrackers. But it goes back to ancient times. They haven't always used the gunpowder the way we use it. One of the things we'll dwell on later this week is how the European powers have come in and wanted to take China out of its isolation. China didn't want to have anything to do with the rest of the world, except as the rest of the world came to it. And back 1,000 years ago, they came from Mongolia, or Tibet, or Burma, or Vietnam. They came up to Peking, to the dynasties of China, to bring their obeisance. There's a word we have in the English which comes from China, which I think well describes the attitude of the Chinese toward the rest of the world for many, many centuries, namely kowtow. Kowtow as the dictionary pronounces it. What's kowtow? You come into the emperor's presence, you get down and you prostrate yourself and knock your head against the pavement a few times to show that you are bowing before the greatest ruler of the world. Every one of these countries which sent its delegations up to Peking had to kowtow.
And when the Europeans got there, about 100 years ago, after all, we didn't know much about China until 100 years ago, a little more than that. And they had difficulty. The British, for instance, didn't want to kowtow. They were from the empire on which the sun never sets, Britannia rules the waves, and their delegations or ministers weren't going to kowtow to these heathen Chinese. Well, the Chinese would pay no attention to them until they did. They finally worked out a compromise so that they respected them, but thereby implied that they were slaves of them. But China's had this attitude of being a center of the universe. And you can't blame them in a sense, because here they were all by themselves in a civilization that they had worked out through the centuries. And all that they knew of the West would be far over here. They would know nothing across the Atlantic, across the Pacific, of course, and not much to the south. They were not a seafaring people. So you don't find Chinese sailors going over the rest of the world to find out where it was. But it's only when the seafaring people of Europe started to come there that they discovered China. But China was a land empire, bound by land, and plenty of it in a sense, but always fighting against those who didn't want to come under Chinese suzerainty. But the Chinese gradually came to understand that there was a power further west here. And one of the interesting stories in medieval history is the adventure of Marco Polo. Do you realize it's 700 years ago since Marco Polo went to China? And if you haven't read the journal of Marco Polo, you'll find it as interesting as any travel sketch today. Here was a Venetian, or an Italian rather, who with his uncle had gone out from Venice up into the what is now South Russia, across the Caspian, and gradually found his way over here to China and came to the port in Peking. And discovered that in Peking there was a government, temples, administration, power and glory of a great empire that no one in the West knew anything about. Probably rivaled anything in the Roman Empire. And yet it was unknown to most of the Romans. There are interesting passages in the Old Testament which make us wonder whether there was some connection between Palestine. There were Chinese who had worked their way over here, and that by trade or by adventure had come in contact, especially with the land routes that went through Palestine. So there may have been some idea that there was a great country off there in the northeast, but certainly in the Old Testament times, no one knew anything about it. Sinim, S-I-N-I-M, you'll find, as a word that refers to this Chinese part of the world. Well, what we're trying to do this week is to find out something of what's happened in this great country. I'm going to divide it into these parts. Today I'd like to speak a little more generally about China and its place in our thinking today. Tomorrow I'd like to go back in the story of China through the dynasties, which ran all the way from about 1,000 years before Christ up to 1912. There aren't many of us that can remember when the Manchu dynasty came to an end. But it's happened in our own lifetime that this dynasty, whose name Manchu reminds you of Manchuria, which had ruled China for so long, was overthrown, and you get a Chinese Republic. And I'd like to speak about the old China. China, by the name, is, by the way, is a name that the people out here gave to China. China is not a name that the people themselves called by, but it came to be the name that foreigners gave to China, and so came to have worldwide significance. we have the word China in porcelain. I suppose more Americans know about China porcelain than they know anything else about China. And the reason? It was discovered in China. China is the one that produced porcelain. The word China itself has lived on in our household goods through this discovery of firing what had been molded and then glazing it to make a thing of beauty. Then thirdly, I'd like to go on from 1912, the days of the Republic, Sun Yat-sen, and Chiang Kai-shek, up to 1949. I suppose there are some among us here who still think Chiang Kai-shek should have been ruling China. Well, here he is, an old man down on Taiwan waiting to die. One while we thought he was the savior of China. And our missionaries thought highly of him because he was supposed to be a Christian. One of the things I'm going to discuss this week, which I'm sure is going to arouse some controversy, is the relationship of our missions to China. It's strange, but probably no part of the world has been so affectionately thought of by the Christian Church as China. Thousands of missionaries have gone to China. And I suppose some of you may have friends or yourself have been in on the Chinese boards or churches. And there was a time when the Chinese mission appealed to all our people. We raised thousands of dollars and did a great deal of work in China. And the question that comes to my mind as I study what's happened, what caused sudden driving out of all the missionaries of China? Oh, I know the answer, communism. Communists won't stand for them, so they expel them. I don't think it's that easy. And in my mind, it raises some very serious questions about the policies of our missionaries, or missionary boards, rather. And that's what makes this study of China so fascinating, that it touches on so many angles of our church life. Were we mistaken in some of the aims in our China policy? Well, I'll raise the question. You can discuss it when we come to it, but it is a problem that affects us today in relationships to other missionary peoples. Another reason that this is such an interesting subject, certainly to a Christian, is that in this country you have the three great religions of the world, in a way that nowhere else. China followed Confucius in the olden times, and Confucianism is one of the great religions, though some people question whether it's really a religion, but certainly people made it a religion. And then you had, coming up from India, Burma, Buddhism. Buddhism is a part of the Chinese picture. Buddhism is arousing interest among Christians today. We have young people asking, does Buddhism have something that Christianity doesn't have? This idea of meditation, losing oneself, consciousness. Confucianism, Buddhism, Muslim, or Mohammedanism, for there is up in this part of China a considerable Muslim population. So that in this great area, the three religions of the world contend against each other. And what happens to them? There is another religion or sect called Lao Tzu, which is a sort of a philosophy which has degenerated into a popular religion. But with Mohammedism, Confucianism, Buddhism, Lao Tzu, and Christianity, all contending here for influence of the people. And one while, it was all confusion. Confucianism. Another while, it was all Buddhism. One while, it looked as if Christianity might make inroads. And yet, there was never a time when over 1% of the Chinese were Christians, which doesn't make it very significant, does it? Except when you find what that 1% was. And I'll come to that when we speak of what has happened in that period of Sun Yat-sen and Chiang Kai-shek, who represent what happened in China from about 1912 to 1949. And then all of a sudden, 1949, all of this becomes communist. Mao becomes the supreme ruler of China. You can have any ideas you want about communism, and I won't discuss them with you, except that I hope you get out of this idea that all evil in the world is communism, and anything that isn't communism is good. One thing you learn is that there are some good things about communist China, whether it's communism or not. But I find fault with our American Christians who become so victims of stereotypes that they gulp up the common attitude. Anything communism is wrong, anything red is wrong, have nothing to do with it. Well, Christianity has to have something to do with it. Christianity is in this world. And we in America have been foolish, I don't think the word is too strong, by saying that after 1949 we would have no relations with China at all. And for 25 years, hardly an American entered China. There were a few Canadians, there were some Europeans, a few Japanese, but we had no direct contact with China between 1949 and about the early 1970s. And yet it's that period in which one man with a little group around him organized 800 million people into a new kind of organization which has made China different from anything it ever was before. So that I don't see how you can avoid being interested in what happened. Out of a country which had, after Chiang Kai-shek or during his time, was divided into warlords ruling here and there and everywhere and clashing against each other, all of a sudden one man emerges. Very slowly, people didn't realize at the time, but he represented the peasants. And 95% of the Chinese are peasants. And Mao's strength is in what he's done for the peasants. And what they are today is something that we are reading a little bit about. I've been struck by the fact that no matter who they are, go to China, they bring back today some similar reports. Well, we want to speak about what happened after 1949, the Cultural Revolution, and the Red Guards, Mao's Red Book, for instance, until last, the fifth day, we'll speak about communism as it exists in China today. So there's plenty of material and plenty to talk about in regard to this great country. Let me go back a moment to the missionaries, because I think that is of interest to us as Christians. And we might be surprised to find that, well, let me say a word about population. No one really knows how many people there are in China, because China hasn't had any census lately, or at least it hasn't circulated. One of the difficulties about knowing China today is that China hasn't been interested in telling the rest of the world what's going on any more than the rest of the world has known. So that no one can point to any census and say that these are the figures. But if we compare, I'd say four or five students or scholars who've studied China, it's generally agreed today there are about 800 million people. Certainly between 750 and 800 million. I'd say one-fourth of the world's population. And they have grown fast. Lao Tzu Red, who has written a very fine history of the missions in China,
And they have grown fast. La Tourette, who has written a very fine history of the missions in China, at the beginning of the century estimated there were 400 million. This was before, of course, the break from the Manchu dynasty. But the rate of growth is rapid, so that we can say within our own lifetime, practically, the population of China doubled. Well, from 400 million to 800 million, what's going to happen from now on? You might think the rest of the world becomes Chinese pretty soon. And of course, there's been a lot of migrations of Chinese. There are a lot of Chinese in Africa. They're not very welcome. There've been some Chinese in the United States. We've tried to keep them out. There've been Chinese in Korea. Chinese have to go somewhere, but on the whole, their problem has been to find a livelihood on the mainland. But here you have a population of, say, 800 million people and growing at the rate of about 2% a year. We'll find that the communists are trying to do something about it and that they have, in a way, succeeded. Before I get to the story of the missions, there are one or two things I think are of interest to us. When you think of China, you think of the Great Wall. People who go to China always want to see the Great Wall. Well, the Great Wall is up here, which was built by China, as we'll see next time, as a defense against the northern enemies. And there are people who say it's the greatest piece of the masonry in the world, stretching for 1,000 miles, this Great Wall built up to a huge proportion. The thrust of the life in China is from west to east. I said that most of the population is in the east because this is a high mountainous region or a plateau and a desert region, so that you have only 5% of the population in all of this part of China and 95% there. But the great physical features are the rivers that flow down out of the mountains, and the Yellow River and the Yangtze River and the Wai River are the three great rivers. Unlike the United States, where our rivers flow from north to south, Mississippi, Missouri, Hudson, whatever, Columbia, the rivers of China flow from west to east, so that you start up here in the highlands and plateaus, then come down into the valleys of the Yangtze, the Yellow, and here is where the population, the culture, and the history, and the problem that China's been. Because these great rushing rivers occasionally have flooded everything, and China has known periods of panic and hunger and starvation by the destruction of crops until our own times, when they've tried to remedy those. But when we think of traveling in China, we'd start here and go up this way, rather than, well, you could start south and go north, but not much traffic. Most of the traffic would come this way on the rivers. And along here, the coast is where you'll find the conflict between the Chinese and Europeans. That we want to speak of next time. In regard to missions, most people are hardly aware that there were missionaries way back in the 13th century. In fact, there were missionaries earlier than that, Nestorian Christians, who belonged to a branch of the Christian Church which had broken from the main Orthodox Church on the question of the divinity of Christ, one or two natures of Christ. The Nestorian Christians had come into China quite early, way back in the early Middle Ages, but they sort of disappeared. But the Roman Catholic missionaries came in the second half of the 16th century, just about the time of the Reformation. So that in 1914, there were 1.5 million Roman Catholics in China. The missionaries were from Europe and largely from Spain and France. The Roman Catholic Church had set up its own clergy, the Catholic bishop, and by the time of the end of the missionary period, when communism took over, there were over 3 million Roman Catholics in China. Some of them had come very early to the court of the ruler in Peking, and we find that they had high positions. The Chinese used some of the early Roman Catholic missionaries as astronomers. These Jesuits were good scholars, philosophers, mathematicians, astronomers, and we find them helping the Chinese emperor to work out his calendar or working out astronomical measurements. Strangely, too, some of these European missionaries taught the Chinese how to use gunpowder in cannon, and so helped the Chinese to catch up with their Western neighbors in warfare. Doesn't seem quite the proper purpose of a missionary, but the Chinese were able to use these Jesuit missionaries to develop scientific ways of waging war. Today, Chinese students come to the United States and learn our physics and go home and produce a nuclear bomb. So Christian America has helped them to catch up in nuclear warfare. Same kind of process we had 500-600 years ago. The Protestant missionaries came later, but they were really more successful than the Roman Catholic. The China Inland Mission was organized by Hudson Taylor, and there were over 600 missionaries in the interior by 1898, or at the end of the century. And all of us, I think, have known something about the great work of the China Inland Mission. In 1893, there were 55,000 Chinese communicants, mostly in the coastal cities, but they grew very rapidly, and the Protestant missions were active in missions and education and came to a very high place in the thinking of the rulers. China's attitude toward mission is something we want to discuss more in detail. And as I mentioned before, the question of who did we try to influence in China goes down to the root question of what is the policy of our missions. Well, I just want to give this general overview today, and there are a few minutes left. Are there any questions you want to ask on what we have try to sketch next time and on 4 times we'll go into more detail on this. Yes.
You really came from America now in the last century to what church in particular? I think the Lutherans were.
As missionaries?
Yes.
The Presbyterians were among the strongest. The Lutherans came rather late, and there weren't many Lutheran missionaries in China until this century. But the Presbyterians were very strong up in Korea. Presbyterians and Congregationalists, though there were a great many Christians from England, missionaries from England, Anglican Church, and the Methodist Church. But the Presbyterian Congregationalists were among the leaders. The Lutherans grew very rapidly, and all of the Lutheran churches had missions. Our own Augustana Church is up in Honan, which is in about the central part, and I think the ODLC was not far distant from them. They tried to come together. Missouri was a little further south, but the number of Lutheran missionaries was rather small compared to the Protestant missionaries. But it goes back to the first decade of this century. I'll have more detailed figures later. Any other questions on the general relationship of China and the rest of the world? Am I correct in my assumption that the Americans know very little about China and wonder what this great country is all about? And I suppose nothing has quite excited us as much as President Nixon's visit, which again is hard to explain. Nixon's always been against communism, and all of a sudden here he shows up and here we are fighting the communists in Vietnam, but making peace with the communists in Peking and Moscow. But I don't want to get into politics, just shows how strange things develop, that question, was it communism we were against, or is there a power politics here in the world? And I suppose there is. For the question is, can this great country become a nuclear power? And do you foresee a time when it might want to fight the United States? That's part of the planning of our Pentagon. How we're going to lob missiles over against China. Actually, the more one reads of the history of China, the more one is impressed by the fact that China never cared much about going outside of its own boundaries. And while it did exercise a certain control over some of the border states, it was more to protect its own boundaries. China has been rather peaceful. And I think that may have something to do with the American attitude. Americans, certainly American Christians, have felt friendly towards Chinese. And probably the feeling is that the Chinese would not make as much trouble as, say, Japan, which has certainly made trouble. Much of the history that we'll speak about tomorrow has to do with the relations between Japan and Russia back here over the peninsula. Remember the where Port Arthur and Vladivostok, Manchurian Railroad, which they've been fighting with over there. But on the whole, China's been rather peaceful. And when Mao speaks today about wanting to keep the peace, he's got the Chinese history back with him in a way that few countries have. It's a very perplexing thing. I wrote a paper for a group 2 years ago or more, and when I was trying to get a title for it, I settled on the Chinese puzzle. For I think the whole thing is a puzzle, and it gets puzzling as you go along and try to understand it. But a puzzle can be very interesting, too. China has become a very interesting puzzle to myself. Any other questions?
It's always been a mystery to me about the inland of China. What are those people, how do they live? Are they like nomads, or the Arabs? And then that goes up close to Tibet, you know. What are they like? They certainly aren't like those the eastern Chinese.
Mostly grazing. Yeah, they're herds up on the plateaus, grazing lands here, and there's a good deal of grazing grassland that they can feed on. And there are trade routes. It's very interesting to follow the old trade routes that went right across here all the way to Italy. And there were merchants that would go back and forth between China. You've got a mixture of people here. The Mongols are not. The Chinese are a mixture themselves. The real Chinese call themselves the Han people, H-A-N. But you have Manchurians, you have Mongolians, you have Tibetans, you have Turkestans, people that we know very little about. You get into a part of the world that didn't have any history written, so it's only by tradition, oral tradition, that you know what has been going on here. But most of the descriptions that you have of people back here are nomads. They move on from place to place where the grassland happens to be. They'll have grassland one year, next year dry off, and move on somewhere else. Much of this is desert, and they have to follow where the crops can grow. But here you have an entirely different culture, the rights culture, and the problems that you have, and there's where you have your overpopulation.
Is there any chance of irrigation over there?
Yes.
In that desert?
You mean up here?
Yes.
No, I doubt up there. It's too high. You have very high mountains with deep gorges. It isn't before they emerge out here, about 1,000 miles from the sea, that you begin to get to plains, and there's irrigation on the communists have a very large irrigation system. They've tried damming these rivers here, and there's a lot of minerals here. China has some of the greatest mineral resources in the world, and the future of China, when they start developing these, is very hard to foretell, because they have precious minerals that are not available elsewhere. So that when they begin to mine or begin to forest, there's a lot of forest land here. And communists have been building up forestry so that the lumber industry would be increasing. The communists have policies of developing the country, whereas before, each little group fought for itself, and there was no common policy. Well, I guess our time is up.